I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Everyone, and welcome to Minute 119 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Dean O'Carroll, an award-winning playwright. Welcome back to the show, Dean.
Very happy to be back. I'm sorry that we're getting in the home stretch on these. This has been a lot of fun.
What can you do? We'll give you a Medal of Honor for it or something like that.
Oh, thanks. Okay, I'll add it to my shelf full of playwriting awards.
There you go. Hey, why not? You deal in fiction, don't you? So there you go.
Absolutely.
All right. So Minute 119 begins with Clarence basically explaining to everybody the point of the film, and ends with Clarence still trying to explain things to George.
Yes. Well, years ago, I remember reading Dave Barry, the humor columnist, describing TV show Ozzie and Harriet, which I must admit I've never seen. And he said, here's the plot of every single episode. Something happens. Ozzie doesn't understand it. Harriet explains it to him, but Ozzie still doesn't really understand. So, like, oh, yeah. I can see how that show was the basis for every sitcom that came after it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, makes sense. Makes sense.
Yeah.
So we ended things yesterday with basically George striking out again, you know, realizing that, you know, he was hoping to find some solace, you know, with his mother, and realizes that that is not going to happen. And she basically kicks him out of the boarding house, and he runs outside and does a close up on the camera. And then this minute begins with the very next frame, where we see Clarence just hanging around on the other side near him. And Clarence just says, strange, isn't it? Each man's life touches so many other lives. And when he isn't around, he leaves an awful hole, doesn't he? So, I mean, I love the fact that in this 10-second interval, Clarence is literally explaining to George and everyone else the entire plot of this movie.
Yeah. And it doesn't feel heavy-handed. It doesn't feel like you're suddenly reading an Aesop's fable and you're getting the moral handed to you. It feels like, yeah, this is the time in the movie where we articulate this.
Right.
It doesn't feel like they're telling, not showing, because boy, have they been showing. It's great. And Henry Travers finds so many good levels in this that you absolutely believe this is the same Clarence with the mind of a rabbit, or the brain of a rabbit, and the heart of a child.
And the heart of a child.
That's the same guy who was giggling about ordering a flaming rum punch and then settling on mulled wine. It's, even though, yes, he's got genuine wisdom here, and he was a fool back there, and a goof. It's all, you absolutely believe that this is the same person. That he's just, even though this is a clown character part in many ways, it still feels believable and real and three dimensional.
And I don't know if I would call him a clown character, but he's a simple character. He's a simple-minded character.
I'm using clown in a very sort of old-fashioned sense of, like, almost in like a, you know, a Commedia dell'arte, or where there's like sort of, you know, there's like the romantic leads and then sort of the supporting like clown characters who help them, you know, get together in sort of the old-fashioned, you know, not necessarily sort of, you know, like real sort of slapstick clown, but sort of that sort of like tier of character, a character who's about sort of being a helper and is comic relief and so on.
Right. Okay. I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
And I mean, basically, the way that this all plays out is just great, because you know they're telling us that, you know, the most of actually, you know what? Have you ever read the short story that this movie is based on, The Greatest Gift?
I haven't. You know, I should sometime, because you know I love this movie so much. I should know more about its origin.
I mean, it's very short. It literally is, I think, maybe 23 pages or something like that. It has almost nothing to do with this movie. You know, the okay. only thing that's connected to it is the idea that a man, you know, finds out what his life would be like if he wasn't around. But he's like a brush salesman. He becomes like a brush salesman to be able to go visit his wife and whatever. And the whole thing just is very strange. But the idea there is you know, the same way they mentioned here, the greatest gift that a person has is his life. And that's what that's the main premise of the story, the movie, everything. You know, you know, this little gift that we've been given, and it doesn't matter what you believe of how man came about, or you know, how we're all created and all that stuff. You know, we don't need to get into all the theological aspects of it or the biology aspects of it. But what it comes down to is that, you know, the gift of life, that's what we all have. And, you know, the way that each of us through the course of our lives interact with so many people, that even just having one person not around changes everything. You know, I think it's really profound the way that this story is just telling it to us straightforward like this.
You know, the first play I really sort of wrote and had put on was when I was in high school. Every year we would do a student written play festival. And I wrote a play that was mostly just sort of a collection of jokes. It was set at an audition, and there was a bad actor who was, you know, at the audition, who was annoying somebody in the waiting room, and then they wound up having to audition together. And then really I just decided, oh, I should probably try to make this play have more of a point. So then I had the play that they were auditioning for and reading scenes from, so the play within the play, have a more serious point. And it was the scene that they were reading from was one character was considering suicide, and the other one was trying to talk them out of it. And I was already It's Wonderful Life fan by that point, so that I had one character, you know, say, oh, I, you know, my life doesn't really matter that much. I'm not George Bailey.
Oh,
and,
wow.
and then I had I think this was the response. This was a long time ago. This was 30-some years ago. I think the response was what I thought was going to be this really brilliant and sharp philosophical line, where I had the other characters say, you know, you never can use the last half inch of a pencil, but without it, the pencil won't work. And I thought this was really sort of, you know, sharp philosophy about how, like, even if you don't feel like you're important, you're a part of, you know, something larger. And so then we get to the point where the actor delivers that line, roars of laughter. The audience is just, you know, a really epic kind of laugh from this. And so I had this interesting feeling of like, oh, the line that I thought was deep and philosophical and meaningful is getting a laugh. So I failed. But on the other hand, like, I make an audience laugh and I love this. So that was that's kind of an origin story for me as a playwright. And me as someone with, you know, some sort of fortune cookie philosophy in his heart.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's great. It says a lot about, you know, what helped you move along in your, you know, throughout your career, just with that little bit of laughter, you know, about a pencil.
Yeah.
Just a line about a pencil.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. And George is listening to what Clarence says, but he's still not believing him. He still thinks that something is amiss here, because he goes, I've heard of things like this. You got me in some kind of spell or something. Well, I'm going to get out of it. I'll get out of it. I know how to. The last man I talked to before all this stuff started to happen to me was Martini. So Is he basically saying that Martini's the one responsible for this? It goes back to what you were saying yesterday, that maybe Martini spiked his drink.
Oh yeah. I suppose, though I can't imagine that George would think ill of Martini. But yeah, it's, I don't know, he's just sort of grasping for something. It's, I mean, suddenly I'm thinking of Inception and things like the spinning top in Inception, just, wanting to have sort of an anchor point. I forget what the
Right.
term they use for those in
Okay.
that movie. And so I think he feels like
A
Martini would
totem.
be
You have to have a
his anchor
totem.
there. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember, so yeah, but that's an interesting point. And of course it's just motivation to get into the graveyard.
Oh, for sure,
And
for sure. But the part of the whole idea is that Martini mentions that George Bailey's his best friend. I don't think George Bailey thinks that Martini's his best friend.
No, but
But he's trying to think of a logical explanation for everything, and he says, "Oh, it must be because the last person I saw was Martini. So now I got to go find Martini, and I'm going to get out of here." And then Clarence basically says, "Well, do you know where he lives?" And he goes, "Sure, I do. I know where he lives. He lives in Bailey Park."
in Bailey Park with his goat.
Yeah, with his that's right. And again, Clarence doesn't even try to get involved here. He doesn't dispute it. He doesn't say, "Oh, you're wrong," or whatever. He's like, "Okay, you know what? You want to go check it out? Let's go check
Yeah,
Let's
he's past that point.
see what you think is going to be in Bailey Park." And
Yeah.
they do, because George is complete, so sure of himself at this point, even after everything that he's gone through, where he can't find Mary and the kids, he couldn't find his mother, or his mother didn't recognize him. Bert and Ernie didn't recognize him. Like, what's going on here? But Martini, he's gonna recognize me.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of that episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. I don't know if you'll if this will be a reference useful for you, where Beverly Crusher, people keep vanishing from the Enterprise until she's the only one left. And probably it's kind of a similar feeling of like, I got to get back to the last time life made sense for me, and so all the layers are falling apart. So maybe but maybe that's still there. Maybe that concrete memory that I have might still be there.
Right.
I do love that when Martini calls George his best friend, because probably a lot of people think of George as their best friend, and he's not really aware of this.
That's right. That's right.
The Tom Sawyer book is very visible in this shot as he's standing there, and it's probably just to keep it in our minds so that we remember it, just a few minutes later when George gets it as a gift. Because I don't think there's any logical or artistic reason beyond that for it to be visible there.
Well,
Just,
because it just Clarence has it, but again, we've seen Clarence over the last 15 minutes, where except for when he was drawing off the book, the book wasn't around, so that must be the reason for us to see it subliminally.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice that it's Tom Sawyer, because Clarence says that he died over 200 years ago, right? So he died sometime in the 1700s, and he was a clockmaker, though that never comes. That sense of like time, I guess, is kind of key to this. And then, of course, Mark Twain, died in the early 20th century, so it's so this is a book, that would not have been around when Clarence was alive.
No,
And
but Clarence
I don't know
mentions
if this.
you should read what he's you should see what he's
The new
writing
ones,
now.
yes, which I think when I first saw this movie, I thought it was a joke about like, oh, he must mean the one that Mark Twain was writing when he died, and then I realized, oh, that time the book. Oh, so Mark Twain is still working on new stuff in heaven, which I loved. That was in The Good Place. We learn towards the end that Shakespeare is still writing plays, but his last 200 or 300 plays haven't been as good. I can't think of any particular reason why how like Tom Sawyer as an actual piece of literature ties to this. I mean, it's a book for children, and Clarence it has a childlike mind. It's not one of Mark Twain's literary works. It's not Huck Finn. It's so okay. There's that. I don't think I have any larger point than that. I like Tom Sawyer. I think it's a good book.
I think it's just a way of throwing it in there. I don't think it's I don't think there's much of a meaning for it, except maybe I mean, again, this is jumping a little bit ahead, but you know, when you know, at the end of the movie, when he opens it, he talks about the, you know, the quote that Clarence has in there is about friendship. So in Tom Sawyer, yeah, friendship is very important to him also. That's, you know, yeah, with Becky and with Hunk Huckabee and stuff like that. So,
yeah. And Tom Sawyer is the all-American boy, and so is George Bailey. So, yeah, I guess that's where you draw some connections.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably the way that you can connect the two there. And then the scene changes, and we're now in what we thought would be Bailey Park, but it turns out to be a cemetery. So before we get into anything,
the logic here.
How does it turn into a cemetery?
Exactly. Okay. So now, when in the scene with Mr. Potter talking to his underling, the underling says, like, oh, yeah, I used to hunt rabbits at the old cemetery near that place. Yeah. So exactly how that works out, I'm not entirely clear. Do we assume that in the prime timeline, to use modern superhero movie terminology, George Bailey dug up a cemetery to build Bailey Park? That seems a little grim.
Well, that's exactly. Yeah. That's one of the places I was going with this, because again, my assumption is that Bailey Park was not something that George started. I think it's something that Peter started.
Okay.
And George, you know, continued with it because Peter was building somewhere. You know.
Yeah. That makes sense.
And if that's the case, that means that already in, you know, the early 1920s, Peter Bailey is building there. And if that's the case, then how did it become a cemetery?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So somehow in a world without George, Peter Bailey does not get started on this project, or does it somewhere else? And so the land that would have become Bailey Park gets turned into a cemetery, because the only gravestones we see are Peter's and Harry's.
Right, and Harry dies in 1919.
Right. So, all right. So we have to accept that something about being a father at an early age led Peter Bailey to want to pursue this idea. He acquires some land that would otherwise have been turned into a cemetery.
I guess.
All right. I'll accept that.
Maybe.
I'll accept that. George's reality, Bailey Park, like, butts up against a cemetery that had shorter boundaries in that world. But okay.
It is very possible that this is on the outskirts of Bailey Park, and that there really is a cemetery.
Yeah. Yeah. I would buy that he's, that this is just, you know, the shortcut, the way to get there would be to walk through this old cemetery.
I'm sure, and I tried looking this up and was a little unsuccessful in finding specific information about, like, what are the laws of, you know, building in an area that has graves around it in New York you know, I couldn't really find the closest I was able to find was that in the U.S., each state has their own laws regarding it, and that one would need to check in your own state and county and town regulations. But as a general rule of thumb, unless one removes each burial to another cemetery, even if you only have one or two graves in a backyard or whatever it is, you know, you have to move the graves first before you can you know, rezone the area for building something. So I don't know, maybe that's what the Baileys did. They rezoned it and moved all the bodies somewhere else, and that would be it.
Right, yes. That which connects this movie then to Poltergeist. So
yes, there you go.
All right, yeah, speaking of Craig T. Nelson, as we did earlier.
That's right, there you go.
So, okay, yeah. All right, so then the most logical explanation would be, yeah, this is just the way to get to Bailey Park. He's at a point where he should be able to see Bailey Park from this point in the cemetery, but of course it's not there. So okay, that makes some
okay. Really logical. Yeah, that makes. A lot more sense.
Yeah, yeah. I do wonder if Peter Bailey was buried in that cemetery, in the original timeline.
Well, that we never see the cemetery. We just that there is a cemetery.
So there's still So there still is some logical inconsistency,
right?
And I wonder if to having Harry and Peter be buried there, that there had to be some sort of change in the timeline other than, yeah, before that. Okay, I think we're going to break our brains if we keep focusing too much on
that. Yeah, well, you know, again, going back to the idea of Hill Valley and Back to the Future, they deal also there with gravestones and with things. So, absolutely. Okay, there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah, that has a weird one where when we see George's obituary, it says local author murdered. But we know that in the 1985 that Marty comes back to in the first movie, he's just getting his first book published. Was George also become an author earlier in this world where he was later murdered? Yeah.
Well, I guess because, you know, if Biff Tannen became so powerful, I need to go and start writing. I need to make money elsewhere. I'm not going to be able to do it in Hill Valley. So why not?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I swear, if you can't discuss minutia like this on a minute by minute podcast, when can you?
Yeah, of course.
You should not feel guilty for indulging in this.
No, I'm fine with it. And then Clarence says to him, "Are you sure this is Bailey Park?" And George responds, "No, I'm not sure of anything anymore."
Claire's just messing with her this book. Yeah.
All I know is this should be Bailey Park, but where are the houses? You weren't here to build them. Your brother Harry Bailey broke through the ice and was drowned at the age of 9. And at this point, we see the gravestone of Harry Bailey, which says that he was born in 1911 and died in 1919. And as we pointed out earlier this week, if you're paying close attention, which apparently I wasn't, on the left-hand side of that, you see another grave, and it says 1928, and that is supposed to be the grave of Peter Bailey, who in this timeline still dies in 1928. So Peter Bailey is destined to die in 1928. It doesn't matter what's going on.
Just, he has a stroke, right? So, yeah, so that was.
He has a stroke, but do you think that stroke was brought on? Do you think that stroke was brought on by Potter?
That's what George thinks. So, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Just stress ahead and deal with Potter, yeah. Now, so we do get into the inconsistency here of Clarence says that Harry was a certain age, but it doesn't match up with the ages or the years on the tombstone. Do you have a headcanon for that? Do you think Clarence just screwed up? Do you think that the engraver screwed up?
No, I think the engraver screwed up because we know that he was 9.
Right, yeah.
And so Clarence goes, "Your brother Harry Bailey broke through the ice and was drowned at the age of 9. That's a lie. Harry Bailey went to war. He got the Congressional Medal of Honor. He saved the lives of every man on that transport. Every man on that transport died. Harry wasn't there to save them." Because apparently there aren't any other good pilots. because you weren't there. And then he gets cut off with what he's saying. But again, it's a very dramatic way to show that, George, without George being around, everything really is going to change.
Yeah. Yeah. That it goes beyond just Bedford Falls. Get to see Bedford Falls, but yeah, those other lives were affected too. Yeah. That part always hit me pretty hard. My grandfather was in the Navy in World War II and was on a aircraft carrier that got hit by a kamikaze, and he survived it, but a lot of his crewmates didn't. So that was always a very powerful moment for me.
Yeah. Do you want to give a guess as to how many military personnel during World War II got the Medal of Honor?
Oh gosh, the Medal of Honor is very prestigious. So, I doubt it's thousands. Is it more than 200?
Yes.
Okay. So how many?
472.
472. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Astounding number of I mean. When you think of war and you think of the number of people fighting in it, so 472 is an insignificant number. But when you think about it, when you count up as opposed to counting down, 472 people doing heroic measures is pretty amazing in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah. I know my own grandfather. He never really liked the whole sort of the greatest generation kind of take on all of that. And I think he was proud of his service and had a lot of memories of it, but wasn't necessarily the biggest fan of sort of the way it was venerated and so on. But I can't disagree with the fact that, you know, these people were called upon to do extraordinary things, and people rose to the challenge.
Right. Exactly. Now, my biggest question, and I pointed this out a few days ago, you know, like, why is Harry playing on the ice with George's friends?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. Was he just the quirky little kid who was tagging along? Or should we even go grimmer, where, you know, because he didn't have a big brother, he was there all by himself, so nobody was there to save him. It's not like one of the other kids could have stepped up, but right. He was totally on his own.
Right. In one of the original drafts of the movie, Harry actually died because George and Harry were playing some game, and something goes over the fence into Potter's property, and Potter starts chasing them, and then Harry ends up falling into the thin ice at that point.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you can see in the movie during that scene, it says property of Henry F. Potter.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. I think I did.
So we know that the area behind is his property. Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I think that was probably a good cut. I think you don't necessarily have to have, you know, Potter be the instigator of all the evils in the world. Sometimes things can just happen.
Well, in Pottersville, he should be, you know.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. That's interesting. Interesting that they consider that. Interesting they chose not to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
So next minute, we actually hear the title of the movie, right?
Yes, yes.
Yes. Okay. So we'll save that for our next episode.
All right. No, great. Every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Inspirational Story Edition, where my guest will give some sort of adventure, misadventure, story, anecdote, something has happened to them over the course of their life that they feel is inspirational to them. So you have a story for us, Dean?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm so intrigued by sort of connections. And of course, this movie is all about the connections that we make in lives and the way our lives affect people. And increasingly in the 21st century, we have fewer of those, at least face to face, because of just, you know, the way technology is taking us, the way we're sort of heading towards being, you know, more on our own, more online and so on, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. You know, I work from home and I'm glad I don't have to drive to an office every day. I think that is a good thing, but it does make the connections that you can make more special. And my family made a very profound connection that I'm so grateful for. A few years ago, we have four kids. My wife is very good at having babies. Four was enough for us. She had at one point thought that maybe a friend of ours who'd been married for a while and not had any kids wondered if maybe she was, you know, having trouble. And she got the idea to offer to be a surrogate for her. She mentioned this to the friend, and the friend basically said, oh, thank you for the kind offer, but actually we've decided we're not going to have kids. And boy, is that a valid choice, a very, very healthy one. Sometimes I think people might think I'm judging them because I have four kids. If I judge people for not having kids, like, no, I think not having kids is a great idea. I love mine. It was the right choice for me, but I'm certainly not saying it's the right choice for everybody.
I thought you were going to say that your wife wanted to volunteer you to help.
Oh, no.
The big chill
character, you know. Invest in this story. Yeah. but that did get the idea of being a surrogate. So she started looking into it. And so she signed up and she became a surrogate. And we were paired with this couple from Sweden, two men from Sweden, where surrogacy is not legal. So they did have to go outside the country to find other help. And so my wife volunteered to be a gestational surrogate. It was not her egg. It was a separate egg donor. And so she did it, and she was pregnant, and she gave birth to a baby for this family. And it was such a profound and wonderful experience to get to do this, to get to help a family get started, like this, and to see just how thrilled they were to have this child and to be with it. And then 2 years later, she did it again, and she gestated another baby for them with the same egg donor. And oh, wow. And we have this connection to this family, and we haven't seen them in a while because, you know, right after she had the second baby, COVID hit. And so they have not been able to visit. They were going to visit the States a little while ago, but I think something went wrong. It's like an airline strike or something. But, you know, but we have this connection to this family, and we exchange Christmas gifts and Christmas cards, and we feel this real sort of profound connection to people who we otherwise never would have met, never would have known. And I, you know, as I said, I'm a minor supporting character in this story. It's all about my, my wife's generosity and desire to help out. Which I should say, you know, we also, we were paid for this. Gestational surrogates are very well financially rewarded. It's not some of you just out of the kindness of your heart, but it's still, you know, it's that, that's giving a lot of yourself. It's more than just, you know, giving blood or, you know, volunteering at a bake sale or something to help somebody out. This is, that is a real commitment. And I'm so proud of my wife for doing that. Wow. And so happy with the connection that we made because of
it. Wow. That is a great story. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. So would you like to once again tell people where they can find Dean or Carol?
Sure. Well, yeah. So if you know someone who has any connection to theater, be it at an educational level, particularly high schools and middle schools, that's my sort of bread and butter, but also community theater, summer camps, regional theaters. If you want to do a play that is comedy, that is a funny take on some beloved franchise, check out some of mine. My biggest hits are my Harry Potter parodies, my series of plays about Sally Cotter, which are Sally Cotter and the Censored Stone, Sally Cotter and the Prisoner of Alcatraz, and Sally Cotter and the Quest We Follow. My other big one is my hit Back to the my play Back to the 80s, which is a parody of Back to the Future, yes, but mostly just a chance to cram in as many cameos from parodies of 80s pop culture as possible. So if, you know, if you know somebody who has a great Mr. T impression, there's a Mr. T cameo and Back to the 80s. So, you know, you could stage that play for them to do. You know, Mr. T calls Pee Wee Herman fool in it, of course. It was so much fun to sort of just regurgitate my own childhood to write that one. I didn't know that one was going to be a hit, but it turns out a lot of theater directors are my age and also wanted to relive that era.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you can check those out from playscripts.com. My favorite of those is my Marvel parody, which doesn't get that as much for whatever reason. But my play Marvelous Squad, I think, is a lot of fun. It has some really good jokes in there.
Oh, wow. So, yeah. Very cool. Okay, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.